fascinating facts, candid conversations, and some levity to lighten your day. This is The Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio.
Welcome to The Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio. We have a very special episode, which I've been looking forward to for a very, very long time. I have a special guest who's going to be joining me for this hour, and I'm going to tell you a little bit about him. He is a convert to the Catholic faith. He is a Catholic priest, and he is the senior research fellow at Blackfriars Hall at the University of Oxford in the UK. He's also doing some work in North America as well. He is professor of apologetics at Houston Baptist University, where he actually taught my producer, Lucas Holt. And he is also the author of the best-selling and award-winning Planet Narnia, The Seven Heavens in the Imagination of C.S. Lewis. He's the co-editor of the Cambridge Companion to C.S. Lewis, and he presented the BBC television documentary, The Narnia Code. On the 50th anniversary of C.S. Lewis's death, he also unveiled a permanent national memorial to him in Poets' Corner in Westminster Abbey in London. His latest book is called After Humanity. It just came out hot off the press, published by Word on Fire Academic. And this book, After Humanity, is really a book about another book. It's a book about C.S. Lewis's famous work, The Abolition of Man. Father Michael Ward is my guest today. He's joining me from his home in Oxford. Father Ward, thank you for taking the time today. How are you?
Hello, Cale. Thank you for having me. I'm very well, though it's raining heavily outside my window. I hope you can't hear it.
I can't. Tell me a little bit about your background. You're a convert, obviously, to the Catholic faith, a former Anglican priest. Tell me a little bit about where you grew up and your faith journey.
Yes, so I was born into an Anglican household. My parents were faithful Anglicans of a conservative evangelical variety. Mm-hmm. They were very much in the vein of John Stott. I don't know if that name means anything
to you. Yes, I do know him.
But yes, our church was very John Stott-like in approach to Anglicanism, and it was a very lively church. So I was baptized and confirmed in the Anglican church and taken to church and taught all the usual things and accepted them and was, you know, very happy Christian in that tradition. Went to Oxford to do my first degree in English and began to be exposed a little bit more to other forms of churchmanship, both higher churchmanships within the Church of England. And for the first time, I was getting to meet some Catholics. I'd been taught to be rather suspicious of Catholics. but when I finally met some, I discovered that they didn't have two heads and that some of them were quite godly and holy people. And so I began to look a little bit more warmly upon Catholicism.
So what eventually led to your conversion to the faith? Were there certain factors that you, or obstacles in terms of theology that you had to get over before you could swim the Tiber, if you will?
Well, the first thing that really put a dent or put a question mark over my Anglicanism occurred in the early 1990s when the Church of England decided that they would start ordaining women priests. And this caused me for the first time to ask myself about church authority. You know, who has the authority to change such a thing as orders, holy orders? You know, for centuries and centuries, it was thought that this was for men, and now it's for women too, apparently. And why this change? And what legitimate authority is there behind this? It wasn't so much that I was, you know, particularly against the change, so much as I was just wondering who had the authority to make any change. And that led me to begin to think about, you know, the founding of the Church of England, which I'd always known was not, you know, covered in great glory, because it was all to do with Henry VIII wanting to change his wife and breaking with the Church of Rome back in the 16th century. Anyway, as I explored these matters, it wasn't anything terribly, you know, problematic for me. It was just more like an intellectual question, and I was still sufficiently comfortable in my Anglicanism to go ahead and get ordained and become an Anglican priest. And I served as a college chaplain at the University of Cambridge to begin with, and then came back here to Oxford to do likewise at St. Peter's College in Oxford. I was chaplain there for 3 years. But during this whole period, I was becoming increasingly questioning about things going on in the Church of England and in Anglicanism more generally. And when I was chaplain of St. Peter's College, Oxford, I was happy to run services during term time, but outside term, when there were no services to run, and I had to look around and ask myself, which church do I want to go to in the university vacations? Although there are dozens, scores of options in Oxford, I couldn't find one that suited me. And I suddenly realised, oh dear, I now belong to the church of Michael Ward. When I'm in charge of the services, I will happily attend them. But when I'm not in charge, I don't really want to go. I don't feel very comfortable anywhere. And I was, rather alarmed by this realisation, because obviously I don't want to belong to the Church of Michael Ward. I want to belong to the Church of Jesus Christ. And I suddenly thought, oh, yeah, right. I need to become a Catholic, don't I? Because around about that time, I was also getting to be a good friend with a recent convert who was pummeling away at my Anglican propositions. And he, after asking me lots of searching, probing questions, basically drove me to the brink where I suddenly realized, oh, yeah, I need to decide on this. And the climactic moment was really, a question about authority. That's where it had all started 20 years earlier in the early 1990s. And now this is 2012. When this final move happens, and I ask him, well, why should I trust the Pope? What gives the Pope any authority? And if his authority is not to be seriously doubted or questioned, then how does that distinguish the Pope from any cult leader? And my friend, rather than ducking the dirty word cult, which I'd put on the table, said, well, what do you mean by cult? Cult doesn't necessarily mean, some crazed sect who are prepared to, drink the Kool-Aid at the command of their cult leader. Cult just means literally a form of worship. And the Christian cult is a form of worship constituted by Jesus Christ with its own particular framework. And so when Jesus said to Peter, you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, when he said to the apostles, he who receives you receives me, he was constituting his own church, his own cult, the cult, the form of worship that would worship the Father through the Son. And he appointed Peter and Peter's successors as his vicars, as his right-hand men, as his, like the prime minister serving the king, in the British constitution. And when I thought of the Pope like that, as having no more authority than Jesus Christ himself, obviously having less authority than Jesus Christ because he's appointed by Jesus Christ.
Right.
Then I thought, oh yeah, well, I'd always been prepared to say I would do whatever Jesus asked of me. And if Jesus has indeed constituted the church in this fashion, then I can reliably trust that Jesus would not have constructed a church that would end up leading me astray. And when I saw it like that, which was the first time I'd ever seen it like that, my problems evaporated. And I suddenly heard a voice deep inside me saying, you are going to become a Catholic.
What I love about that, too, is that we often hear from people, from converts, oh, I read my way into the church. And no doubt you did a lot of research of your own. But there's always someone involved. There's always a person involved, a friend, someone who gets you thinking along those lines. And telling me about your friend who is grilling you, asking you deep questions about the Catholic Church and your take on it, I think that's just a really insightful a part of your conversion story. And speaking of friends, we have to talk about a good friend of C.S. Lewis's, J.R.R. Tolkien, who, of course, was instrumental in his life, his accepting of Christianity in general. And I think at some level, it was a little bit disappointing to J.R.R. Tolkien, who was a Catholic, of course, author of The Lord of the Rings, and a great member of the Inklings, that little society that he formed with C.S. Lewis and a couple others. They met at the Eagle and Child pub and would often talk together and share ideas. You converted from Anglicanism to Catholicism. Why do you think that C.S. Lewis never did become Catholic himself, even though he held to a lot of Catholic beliefs? He believed in auricular confession. You alluded to earlier, Father Ward, about the ordination of women. C.S. Lewis famously wrote an essay called Priestesses in the Church? He obviously didn't buy into that either. Why do you think he never became Catholic in the end?
Well, he himself would answer by saying that he wasn't persuaded of the authority of the Pope. In a letter to a Catholic, he said that's really the major point of disagreement from which all the other disagreements ultimately flow. Why he was not convinced of the Catholic claim is a very complicated matter. He was, of course, raised in a Protestant household in Ulster in the north of Ireland.
Right.
And, of course, from a Catholic point of view, it's that which, it's pretty much provides a sufficient explanation for his disinclination to embrace Catholicism, that he was just raised with such a deep and abiding suspicion about Catholicism, because it divided the whole community particularly badly back then. And even today, Northern Ireland is a very sectarian culture. It may just have been slightly impossible for him to have come to any different belief. But, that's not, of course, how he would see it. He would say, no, I'm assessing these things rationally. I'm not just conditioned by my upbringing, and I'd come to a different view. I think we should respect his own difference of opinion on this matter, and while disagreeing with it, be glad that he was given as much light as he was, and he was a huge benefit to the worldwide church, not just the Anglican church, but to the Catholic church too. And any number of Catholic people have benefited from his own wisdom. And if he wasn't granted the light to enter the Catholic church, well, that's between him and God. And it's not for us to judge his own motives. I sometimes think, Peter Kraft has said this too, that, C.S. Lewis didn't become a Catholic because God didn't want to become a Catholic. Which is, I think that's slightly tongue-in-cheek because, of course, God wants everyone to come to a knowledge of the truth, and the more truth, the better. But, of course, if C.S. Lewis had become a Catholic, he would instantaneously have lost a lot of his draw to evangelicals and Protestants and Anglicans, many of whom have been persuaded to become Protestants and evangelicals and Anglicans, and having become those things, they then go on to become Catholics. I've heard it said that C.S. Lewis is like Moses, that he leads people to the promised land but doesn't enter it himself. But as you say, he was a very Catholically minded Anglican. He went to confession. He believed, had a very high view of the priesthood, a high view of the Eucharist. He believed in purgatory. So he was, as an Anglican, he was almost as Catholic as he could have been without becoming.
Yeah, that's a fascinating take, Father Ward. And I once had dinner with a biographer of C.S. Lewis who said exactly the same thing, that he never was able to overcome the Catholic prejudices that he grew up with, and often we're not aware of our own prejudices, and it's hard to be self-reflective perfectly on those issues. Well, let's talk about your new book on a book about a book by C.S. Lewis, and The Abolition of Man has been called by the Intercollegiate Studies Institute the second best book of the 20th century. I don't know what they ranked as number one, but your book, After Humanity, is about that book. It's about the abolition of man. What is the abolition of man about? What was the origin story, if you will, of this work?
The Abolition of Man is a short, very slim little book. It consists of three lectures that Lewis gave during the Second World War on whether value is objective or not. So it's a defense of the objectivity of value, And it's also a forecast about what will happen to us if we can continue in a increasingly subjectivist approach to ethics, if we think that we just make up right and wrong out of our own choices rather than recognizing things as objectively right and wrong. So that's basically what the book is about, that ethical question about whether we make up value or rather recognize it, whether we discover it or invent it. And it's a book which many Catholics have praised highly. Pope Benedict XVI, when he was still Cardinal Ratzinger,
that's right.
He praised the keen accuracy of Lewis's work in this book. And Hans-Urs von Balthasar, the Catholic theologian, has talked about the taut brilliance of Lewis's argument. And the way that Lewis develops his argument is very much in accord with natural theology, with natural law philosophy, the sort of thing that you see very much in the work of St. Thomas Aquinas. Though interestingly, Lewis doesn't make an explicitly Christian case. He's making a purely philosophical case, and he's not resting his argument on a belief in God, or even, let alone, a belief in the Christian God. It's purely philosophical. And Lewis had studied philosophy at Oxford, and he taught philosophy in his first academic position. And that's one of the reasons why I think people often find The Abolition of Man difficult, because they're expecting a work of Christian apologetics like you would get in Mere Christianity, say.
Right.
And here Lewis is working on a different wavelength.
Yeah, and that's a great point. I want to get into this natural law question in just a minute. And by the way, you're listening to The Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio. My guest is Father Michael Ward, author of the new book, After Humanity, A Guide to C.S. Lewis's The Abolition of Man. Before we get into that, I want to ask you this question. Why did you call your book After Humanity?
Three reasons. First, obviously, it's a nod to Lewis's own title, The Abolition of Man. Lewis is predicting that if we continue in a subjectivist direction, then we'll basically be abolishing an important part of our own humanity. And he himself uses the term post-humanity in the course of his book. So After Humanity glances at that. Secondly, I chose that title because it's a nod to that great work of philosophy by the Catholic philosopher Alastair MacIntyre, After Virtue. That's a very influential book that he published in 1981, I think. And the argument that Alastair MacIntyre makes in After Virtue is very similar to the argument that Lewis makes in The Abolition of Man. So I'm nodding in that direction. And thirdly, although, as I just mentioned, The Abolition of Man isn't an explicitly Christian book, you can certainly see traces of Lewis's Christian commitments. So, for instance, he ends the book, or at least he ends the appendix to the book, with a quotation of the verse from John's Gospel about unless a grain of wheat die, it remains alone. But if it dies, it bears much fruit. He who loves his life will lose it. But he who loses his life for my sake and the Gospels will find it. So he ends the book by pointing towards the words of Christ, and the implication of that choice to end the book on that very Christian note is a little hint, a pointer, that if it's to Jesus Christ that we should look if we're seeking after humanity. So After Humanity has that third and more Christian sense too.
Yeah, I like that. And you're listening to Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio. My guest is Father Michael Ward. One of the most fascinating aspects, Father, of The Abolition of Man, and you alluded to this just a moment ago, in many ways it's a defense of the natural law, the natural moral law. But he doesn't really talk about that, C.S. Lewis, in typical categories. For example, only once does he use that term, the natural law. And he doesn't mention the greatest proponent of the natural law, St. Thomas Aquinas. And you mentioned him just a moment ago as well, the angelic doctor. But he does talk about it in terms of Eastern philosophy, the Tao from Confucianism. And there's a statement that he makes, only those who are practicing the Tao will understand it. Why does he use this category, and what does this mean?
Yes, he chooses this term Tao, T-A-O, from Confucian philosophy, not because he's wanting to say there's anything special about Confucianism. You know, he's not suddenly become a Chinese philosopher. but he's deliberately kind of wrong-footing those who think that he's just going to make another standard, you know, Christian apologetic. This is him, as it were, signaling, no, I'm making a philosophical point here. I'm trying to define what it is that makes us human beings from an ethical point of view. Because, of course, you can only be a Christian human being if you're a human being first. So what does it mean to be human? Let's sit down and define what it means to be human. And his definition is, from this ethical point of view, the ability to recognize things as objectively good and evil, or right and wrong. And this is a feature of humanity in general. It's not a feature of specifically and peculiarly of Christians or Westerners. All people have been given conscience. All human beings have been made in the image of God. And, you know, if we were to make the argument from a more biblical point of view, we would quote St. Paul in the letter to the Romans, talking about how the Gentiles who are outside the law nonetheless are a law unto themselves. They have the law written in their hearts, which now acquits them and now condemns them. So it's this idea of conscience, this innate, intrinsic, and really inescapable sense, this faculty we have that attunes us to questions of right and wrong, which makes us human and which distinguishes us from the animals. And that's the case whether we're Confucians or Hindus or Buddhists or Jews or Christians or humanists, whatever we are. And that's why at the end of the book, in the appendix, Lewis cites any number of these cultures and traditions across the world and down through history, all of which testify to this innate moral awareness. Obviously, there are differences. Yeah. They're not all identical in every respect, but there's a huge overlap between these different traditions. The significant thing is, above all, that all these different traditions thought that they were recognizing something real. They weren't just projecting these values from their own, you know, personal whims or preferences. They were discovering something about the ethical ecology of the universe as it is structured and as we have to perceive it if we are to remain human.
That's right, the way things actually are. You're listening to The Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio. My guest is Father Michael Ward, author of the brand new book, After Humanity, A Guide to C.S. Lewis's The Abolition of Man. We've got to take a quick break right now on the program, but when we come back, we're going to talk about this arresting image that C.S. Lewis uses, men without chests. We'll be right back on The Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
This is The Cale Clark Show, giving you the confidence you need to bring the faith into everyday life.
Welcome back to The Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio. I'm joined by a very special guest today, Father Michael Ward, author of the new book, After Humanity, A Guide to C.S. Lewis's The Abolition of Man. And Father Ward, Lewis provides an arresting image in The Abolition of Man, men without chests. What on earth does this mean?
He has an image of the human person in three parts: the head, the chest, and the belly. And this is a kind of philosophical image of how we are constituted from an ethical point of view. In the head, we have rational thoughts. We are logical. We are spiritual. You know, we have a mind. We don't just have a brain. And to that extent, we are intelligent creatures, not very dissimilar from the angels. We are rational. We have that rational light. But in the belly, we have sensations, which angels do not have. Angels don't have bodies, but human beings do have bodies. We have senses, we have passions, we have emotions, because in that respect, we are like the animals. But We also have the chest. And the chest is the liaison officer, Lewis argues, between rational man and visceral man. It's this chest, this middle compartment, which connects the head and the belly. And so the head can rule the belly through the chest. You know, the aim in our moral life is not to suppress or deny or escape the passions or our emotions or our senses. God has made us with bodies for a very good reason, and in the incarnation he has shared our fleshly nature. You know, the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. So we must not despise the body, but we need to be able to control it. We mustn't be, you know, led astray by our own passions and emotions, but neither must we completely squelch them. We need to train them. We need to stabilize them, regularize them. And that's what happens in the chest. The chest is the place where our sentiments become stable and just and civilized, so that we can feel, yes, we can have these passionate emotions, but they are always governed by practical reason. So the chest is what defines us as human beings. It's the chest that makes us rational animals. Connect the angel in the head with the animal in the belly, and you have the anthropological, you know, the truly human in the chest. Connect the human belly and the human brain in the human breast, and you have a human being. That's his basic argument. And the reason he calls the first chapter of The Abolition of Man Men Without Chests is because he's diagnosing a situation in which there's no attempt to stabilize emotions and passions. The idea is that there's no rational way in which passions can ever be incorporated into a moral existence. We just need to escape them, that in a subjectivist attitude. And that's what he faults as so bad for the future of the human race. This is going to lead eventually to our own abolition. We will either evaporate upwards into pure spirituality, becoming like the angels or possibly like the demons, or we will descend downwards into mere animality or become like the beasts. But either way, our peculiarly human attributes will vanish.
Yeah, and this is something that Lewis is a little bit pessimistic about in terms of, in many ways, he prophesied the situation in which we find ourselves now. Pope Benedict, who obviously, as Joseph Ratzinger, was a big fan of Lewis's work, he has coined the phrase the dictatorship of relativism, in which there doesn't seem to be, well, really the only truth that people want to accept is the idea that there is no truth, but that itself is a truth statement, so it's a little bit self-refuting, obviously. But Lewis didn't exactly have a rosy picture painted in this book of how things were actually going to shake down. He wasn't that hopeful about the future, was he?
Not in this book, no. It's a warning. It's a forecast of a rather dystopian future. If we don't make a course correction, we're going to end up in a very bad place. That's Lewis talking in the 1940s. And I think, you know, here we are in 2021, and a lot of what he has forecast has become true. And we increasingly, human beings have no respect for themselves, let alone the natural world at large. We increasingly see both ourselves and nature in general as just so much raw material to be chopped up and to suit our own convenience, but without recognizing its own innate integrity. And so this is precisely what Lewis forecast. And that's why, you know, Joseph Ratzinger and other Catholic thinkers have regarded this as such an important and vital book. And Lewis himself, we ought to add, you know, he regarded it himself as one of his more important works. He said, it's almost my favorite among my books. Mm. And lots of Lewis scholars have thought similarly. Lewis's great editor and biographer, Walter Hooper, another Catholic convert, as it happens, who sadly died in December, He described the abolition of man as an all but indispensable introduction to the entire corpus of Lewis's body of work. So it's anybody who's got any interest in C.S. Lewis needs to wrestle with the abolition of man. But it's a rather difficult work because, as I say, it originated as these three high-level philosophical lectures. And therefore, you know, it does need a guide, which is, you know, precisely why I've written this book.
And it is a great guide. In fact, Peter Kraft, who you mentioned earlier, calls it the best guide to C.S. Lewis's The Abolition of Man. I'm talking with Father Michael Ward, author of the new book, After Humanity, which is about that very topic. And C.S. Lewis was not, Father Ward, he was not an ivory tower intellectual. He was literally, quite literally, in the trenches. And this wartime analogy seems appropriate because the ideas that he talks about in this book have real-world consequences. This is not just, you know, scholars sitting around in rooms that are feature oak-covered walls, smoking their pipes. Lewis was literally in the trenches. Talk to me about Paddy Moore, his relationship with Paddy Moore, what this was all about, and how this influenced his work, especially The Abolition of Man.
The center of After Humanity, I've got a photo gallery of 30 pages of photos.
It's beautiful.
One of these photos shows C.S. Lewis in uniform as a young officer cadet in the British Army during the First World War. And alongside him is a fellow cadet called Paddy Moore. And Lewis and Moore happen to, you know, be put in the same room, in the billet, just because of the alphabetical arrangement of the rooms, Lewis and Moore, L and M. And although they only knew each other for a few months, it turned out to be an absolutely crucial relationship as far as C.S. Lewis was concerned, because he promised Paddy Moore that if the worst happened, that he, Lewis, would look after Paddy Moore's mother and sister, because there was no father on the scene. And when Paddy was killed, Lewis kept his promise and lived with Mrs. Moore and Maureen Moore, the daughter, for decades afterwards. It changed the whole course of Lewis's life. And what does this have to do with the abolition of man? Well, in the course of the abolition of man, Lewis argues that the real test of the objectivity of value is suffering. Until we actually have to suffer for doing the right thing, it's hard to tell whether it's truly objective or not. You know, it might just be suitable for us. It might just be convenient. It might just be advantageous. But if we find that we have to do the right thing, even if it's difficult, painful, and may even result in our own death, like defending our nation against an aggressor, well, then we can tell that it's a really objective thing. So this is why Lewis homes in on death for a good cause as what he calls the experimentum crucis, the crucial experiment, the critical experiment that shows us whether value is objective or not. And as you rightly say, this is not just an abstract philosophical point that Lewis dreamt up, you know, between pipes. It's something that he had seen up close and personal. It wasn't just that he had seen friends and comrades die. It wasn't just that he'd lost Paddy Moore. He himself, C.S. Lewis, was very nearly killed in the First World War. A shell exploded in his trench and killed the man next to him. Very nearly killed Lewis. Lewis had a sort of out-of-body experience in which he thought he was dying. So he came very, very, very close to death himself. And therefore he knew what he was talking about when he would later, in The Abolition of Man, talk about, you know, the old Latin tag from the Roman poet Horace, dulce et decorum est pro patria mori, it's sweet and seemly to die for one's country. And Lewis wants to make that the sort of cornerstone or the testing ground of his whole argument about objectivity of value. And he knew what he was talking about because he'd seen death up close and personal.
Yeah, and he actually, I guess you could say, and you touch on this too in the book, the idea of Christ on the cross. Now, he doesn't slip in his Christian worldview, C.S. Lewis and The Abolition of Man, until the very, very end in the appendix, when he gives this quote from John's Gospel, John 12:24, unless a grain of wheat falls into the earth and dies, Talk to me about the concept of Christ on the cross as the summit of sacrificial love, the kind of self-sacrifice that the poet Horace spoke about. It's good and fitting to die for one's country. And how in Christ, the human chest has reached its highest development. Here we have a man with a chest, not just a man, but the God-man himself.
Absolutely. And it's signaled earlier on in The Abolition of Man, even before we get to the quotation from John's Gospel, when Lewis talks about the quote from Horace, Dulce et decorum est, he says, you know, he just slips in alongside that. And another example of this is greater love hath no man. Hmm. And there again, a quotation from John's Gospel, Jesus is saying, greater love hath no man than this, that a man lay down his life for his friends. Yes, it's highly appropriate that therefore, at the end of the appendix, he returns to that point because, yeah, in Christ we see the epitome, the summit of self-sacrificial love, because Jesus freely embraces the pain of the cross. It's not doing him any immediate good. It's causing him to sweat blood in the garden. It's causing him any amount of physical and psychological and spiritual agony. But he knows that it is the right thing to do. And he, you know, he sets his face like flint and endures the cross, despising its shame for the glory that is set before him. And this is, yeah, this is the very archetypal example of the objectivity of value, the real good despite all the awful suffering that you have to go through in order to achieve it. So yes, in Jesus Christ we see the chest, this human, this definitively human faculty brought to the highest pitch of development. And that's why I have it also in the photo gallery, a picture of a detail of a Calvary picture. And I don't want to turn The Abolition of Man into an explicitly Christian argument. It isn't. It's philosophical.
Right.
But we ought to be alive to these, you know, these Christian dimensions within the argument. They're definitely there.
They sure are. And you're listening to The Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio. My guest is Father Michael Ward. We're discussing his new book, After Humanity, A Guide to C.S. Lewis's The Abolition of Man. We've got to take a quick break here, but we'll be right back. And I'm going to let you know about the other career that Father Ward has on the silver screen, including a James Bond film. We will have that and much more right after this break on Relevant Radio.
Explaining the faith so you can explain it to others. It's the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.
Welcome back to the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio. I'm joined by Father Michael Ward, who's a convert to Catholicism. He's a Catholic priest. He's also the author of After Humanity, a guide to C.S. Lewis's book, The Abolition of Man. And you can find this book, a great place to look for more information on this book and how you can order it, is if you go to the website wordonfire.org/humanity. wordonfire.org/humanity. We'll provide a link in the show notes. And when you order through the publisher, there's an extra bonus thrown in. There's actually going to be a copy of C.S. Lewis's The Abolition of Man thrown in as a bonus. And of course, After Humanity is really a guide to this great work by C.S. Lewis. And Father Ward, I wanted to talk about a beautiful image, and by the way, the aesthetics of the book are just great. The publisher, Word on Fire Academic, did such a great job with this. The photo gallery that's in there is just beautiful. A lot of rare images of people, places, and things that are connected to C.S. Lewis and his world and the book. But this beautiful image of the waterfall on the cover, this image, just like the image of Men Without Chests, is also pretty arresting. What does the waterfall have to do with The Abolition of Man?
I suggested to the publisher that they find an image of a waterfall for the front cover, and they found a beautiful one. It's a real waterfall in Indonesia. Very spectacular image, and I was so pleased with it. I'm absolutely thrilled with the job that they've done designing and producing this book. And I suggested the waterfall because The Abolition of Man opens with a discussion of a waterfall by two people that Lewis names Gaius and Titius. These just nicknames.
Not their real names.
Not their real names. he's talking about two authors of a school textbook. They're discussing a waterfall. Is it right to call the waterfall merely pretty, or is it better to call the waterfall sublime? And these two men, Gaius and Titius, their real names were King and Ketley, they say, well, it doesn't really matter, because either way, all you're doing is expressing your own private sentiment, your own personal subjective viewpoint. There's nothing inherently sublime or even pretty in a waterfall. It's just, you know, a label that we arbitrarily choose to stick upon it, depending on what mood we're in, basically. At any rate, this is how Lewis, you know, starts his argument against subjectivism. It's a kind of springboard into these larger questions about not just aesthetic value but moral value.
Right.
And that's why it's there on the front cover.
Yeah, the true, the good, and the beautiful, and that's certainly a beautiful image. And when we talk about beauty, we also talk about music, and you dedicate this book, very interestingly, you dedicate this book to somebody who passed away last year, Ennio Morricone, the composer. Why did you dedicate this book to him?
Yes, Ennio Morricone, the great Italian film composer, he died a year ago. While I was, you know, deep in the last gasp revisions to my book, and I was wondering who I should dedicate the book to, and then when he died, I listened again to some of his music and watched again the film The Mission, which he wrote the soundtrack for. Yeah,
incredible movie.
And The Mission opens with a very arresting image of a man on a crucifix disappearing over a waterfall in South America. And in the background, of course, Morricone's music is playing. And this obviously connected with The Abolition of Man because of the waterfall, but it connects with C.S. Lewis more generally because Lewis had quite a high view of the symbolic value of waterfalls. There are significant waterfalls in several of his books, Out of the Silent Planet and The Last Battle, and in particular, The Great Divorce. In The Great Divorce, there's a huge heavenly waterfall, which turns out to be an angel crucified, pouring himself down with loud joy into the valley below. So all these connections between waterfalls and C.S. Lewis and The Mission and Morricone made me think, yeah, Morricone, I'll dedicate it in his memory. And as I rewatched The Mission, I came across this great line exchanged between Jeremy Irons and Robert De Niro, where De Niro is told by Jeremy Irons not to take up arms in defense of the mission. You know, you mustn't rely on sheer brute strength to enforce your will. There's got to be something higher than that. If might is right, Jeremy Irons says, if might is right, love has no place in the world. You know, we mustn't confuse power and goodness. You know, just the most powerful man is not the best man, necessarily. In other words, it's sometimes good to suffer and die. Sometimes good to be powerless, you know, depending on the situation. We mustn't confuse might with right. So there in The Mission, there's a powerful sort of, you know, encapsulation of Lewis's whole argument. And I quote that line in the concluding chapter of the book. And indeed, right at the last of the concluding chapter, I turn to a different sort of take on this image of the waterfall. But I'll leave your listeners to turn to the book and read that for themselves. I don't want to give away all the spoilers.
We don't want to spoil it for them. They're going to want to go out and get that. Go to wordonfire.org/humanity to order After Humanity, this wonderful book by my guest today, Father Michael Ward. It's all about C.S. Lewis's The Abolition of Man. Yeah, it all ties together with the waterfall theme and the movie, The Mission, which is a great film. Everybody should see that film if you haven't already. And speaking of movies, you've got a bit of a career on the silver screen as well. Apparently, you also worked at Q Branch in the movie The World Is Not Enough, featuring Pierce Brosnan as James Bond. You handed a pair of X-ray spectacles to James Bond alongside Desmond Llewellyn, who, of course, the late Desmond Llewellyn, who played Q. How did you get into this movie? How did this all happen?
Well, I owe it all really to C.S. Lewis indirectly, because there was that film made about C.S. Lewis called Shadowlands, made by Richard Attenborough, starring Anthony Hopkins and Deborah Winger. And when that was made here in Oxford in 1993, they needed a load of local people to be extras. And I managed to get into that film as an extra. And having got into that film, my name then stayed on the books of the agency that supplied extras to filmmakers whenever they came to Oxford or to near Oxford. And so every now and again, they'd ring me up, this agency, and ask me to be in some film or TV show. And one day they rang up and said, what are you doing next Monday and Tuesday? Do you want to be in a film? And by this stage, I'd got rather blasé about it. It would become slightly boring and old hat. And so I said, I don't know. Tell me what the film is first. And they said, it's the new James Bond movie. And so I said, yes, I'm definitely free for that. And not only was it a James Bond movie, it was the only movie I was ever in as an extra, in which I got to properly interact with the stars. Because, as you say, I ended up handing a pair of X-ray specs to James Bond and got to chat with Q. And, I actually had a featured reaction. I got paid extra for an angry look I had to shoot at James. So it was all fantastic. And it was all, indirectly owing to C.S. Lewis and Shadowlands.
That's amazing. And I can relate to that because I was an extra in the movie Titanic. I didn't get any screen time, though. Some of my friends really did get in some of the shots, close-ups. I was really jealous of them. But I'm a huge James Bond fan, so I think it's just great that you did this. And you're going to be in another film about C.S. Lewis, his conversion. Tell me about that.
Yeah, there's just recently been made a film called The Most Reluctant Convert. And it's based on a stage play. A one-man stage play featuring the actor Max MacLean as C.S. Lewis, talking about how he became, first of all, a theist and then indeed a Christian. And last year, it was filmed. It was turned into a movie, and Max MacLean takes the role of the older C.S. Lewis, but the younger C.S. Lewis is played by this young up-and-coming actor called Nicholas Ralph, who's just become really famous for taking the lead role in All Creatures Great and Small, the veterinary program, which is doing great success. Absolutely. Both sides of the Atlantic. Anyway, the director of the movie, Norman Stone, has a long-standing interest in C.S. Lewis. He made the original BBC Shadowlands, which led later to the Anthony Hopkins Shadowlands. Mm-hmm. And Norman Stone made a documentary about my book, Planet Narnia. I think you mentioned it in the introduction.
I did.
The documentary is called The Narnia Code. So when Norman Stone knew that he was coming to Oxford to make this new movie, he thought, I've got this little part, C.S. Lewis's vicar. I think Michael Ward might just be able to do that. He's done a bit of acting, and he used to be an Anglican vicar in any case, and he's now a Catholic priest, so it shouldn't be too much of a stretch for him. and he got me to play the vicar of Lewis's parish church, and I actually have lines. I don't just have angry looks. And it was great fun. They had to fit me out with a wig and everything. I even got to wear my own vestments. There are Catholic vestments in this film about an Anglican. And it's great fun. I've seen the film. It's been shown to cast and crew, but it won't be coming out publicly until November, early November, I'm told. And Tolkien features in it. There's the famous discussion between Lewis and Tolkien, which led to Lewis's Christian conversion. And it's really good. It's a very thorough, faithful account of Lewis's conversion, mostly derived direct from his autobiography, Surprised by Joy. So I strongly encourage people to keep their eyes open for it.
Yeah, and the title of that film again is?
The Most Reluctant Convert.
The Most Reluctant Convert. Well, where can people find out more about you and your work, Father Ward?
I've got a website, michaelward.net, www.michaelward.net, which, just tells people about the books I've written and essays and articles and some of my speaking engagements and things like that. That's a way that people can contact me if they wish to. I'm also on Facebook. I don't do Twitter, I'm afraid. But
got to get on there.
Facebook is enough, I think.
Well, I really want to thank you for taking the time. It's great to run you down. My guest today was Father Michael Ward, discussing his new book, After Humanity, A Guide to C.S. Lewis's The Abolition of Man. You can order that book and find out much more about it at wordonfire.org/humanity. Father Ward, thank you so much for this conversation. I really, really enjoyed it.
So did I. Thanks for having me on, Cale.
You're most welcome. God bless you. And thanks for listening to The Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio. You can run me down on my Twitter account. Yes, I am on Twitter, at Cale Clark, C-A-L-E, Clark with an E. If you want to give us some comments about this program, what you enjoyed about it, you can email me, cale@relevantradio.com. And we also have a show account on Twitter, at Cale Clark Show. We'll see you in the next episode. God bless you.
Goodness, I can't believe I'm really speaking to you.
Yes, you are. Oh, the wonder of it all.
A Bible study like no other.
Did we do the letter thing?
And a host who's one of a kind.
Most of the cheese is still on the cracker here. Oh, I forgot the... Oh, this is the word of the day. I forgot the gong.
Remember, radio is not yet an exact science, especially when I'm on it.
Father Simon says...
Oh, gosh, more cheese slipping off the cracker.
1 p.m. Central on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.